Hello, I'm Garni Barkajarian of the Pacific Neuroscience Institute and CNS member for more than 10 years. What I love most about being a member is access to cutting-edge science and the opportunities that have advanced my career. I've also gained new colleagues and lifelong friends. Being a CNS member has been so rewarding. The value of membership cannot be defined by a number. Join me and the over 10,000 neurosurgeons who are making a difference in the world. Visit cns.org/membership podcast today.
Welcome everyone to a new episode of the CNS Journal Club podcast, this time for the month of May. And thank you so much for joining us today to all our loyal listeners. My name is Kimberly Huang and I'm from the Department of Neurosurgery at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. My practice focuses on tumors and it is my honor today to moderate the discussion of a very interesting article in the newest edition of the Red Journal, hot off the presses, and it's entitled Price Transparency for Cervical Spinal Fusion Among High-Performing Spine Centers in the United States. And I'd like to take a little bit of time to introduce our distinguished guests and our resident co-planners. So Dr. Mooney, if you'd like to start off.
Sure, thanks so much. And for both the invitation and the great discussion that I look forward to having. I'm Michael Mooney. I'm a neurosurgeon here at the Department of Neurosurgery at the Brigham in Boston. I do tumor and spine surgery here and also serve on the Brigham value-based care team with some research and clinical interest in healthcare delivery and health systems. So relevant to what spurred some of this work.
Perfect. Dr. Jay, how about you?
Hi, my name is Andrew Jay. I'm a pediatric neurosurgeon at the University of Oklahoma. I just stepped into an interim chair role for our department about 2 weeks ago now. I also have a spine practice, both pediatric and adult. So this article by Dr. Mooney really fascinated me.
Great. And Dr. Shi.
Hi, I'm Helen Shi. I'm a 6PGY6 resident at the University of Oklahoma. I'm also a CSNS social economics fellow. So that's part of the reason why this article drew my attention. I think it's important that we discuss the social economics of neurosurgery.
Yes, totally agree. Very important and something we maybe don't talk about enough. Dr. Mooney, do you want to go ahead and give the audience some highlights about your work?
Yeah, thank you. So the idea for this paper came as an extension of work that I performed when I was in my residency training, where we published a paper in the Red Journal as well, looking at cost transparency as well as out-of-pocket cost for neurosurgical patients. This interested me even back then because healthcare delivery is a unique economic encounter where patients commit to a set of services with very limited knowledge of the costs that they might face. And I think this is particularly relevant in neurosurgery and in spine surgery, where some of our operations are elective and the variety of complexity and cost can be quite high. So I think particularly relevant to our specialty for that reason. So we initially looked at that paper that was in 2019, looking at hospital and professional costs that were billed to patients from a single institution, 13,000 surgeries, specifically with an interest in what patients actually paid, patient out-of-pocket cost. And that was in 2019, as there was a lot more discussion starting around cost transparency. Fast forward a little bit to January 2021, the Hospital Price Transparency Final Rule, HPTFR, as it's referred to in the paper, went into effect, which is a mandate that applied to hospitals for a specific set of 70 different surgeries and mandated that hospitals have to report the specific costs, as well as a number of other factors related to those essential services. So that spurred kind of a follow-up of that paper. About 2 years had passed since the mandate, and we wanted to specifically look at how cost reporting was being performed for one of those essential services, which was cervical spine fusion. Relevant to us as neurosurgeons and spine surgeons. In the paper, we examined the reporting from 332 what were deemed high performing spine centers. And this was a designation that was laid out by the US News and World Report for spine centers across the country. Selecting these 300 that they title high performing, we decided to examine them and see how was their compliance and reporting in accordance with or not in accordance with the mandate that was put forward in 2021. So that's a bit of the background. And to highlight a few of the main things about the paper, I think for me can be distilled down into three kind of main take-home points or facts. The first one, that I think is the key takeaway, is that we were able to analyze those 332 high-performing spine centers and see that 99% of them had a price transparency tool available on their webpage that you were able to access and analyze some kind of data. So that's something. However, if you actually look at the compliance, the actual mandate specifications as to what is required to be reported, only 10% of the centers in that category met those criteria. The main place they fell short was in reporting minimum and maximum negotiated charges. These were often not included, and in fact, it's probably one of the more relevant cost items that patients would utilize if they were to try to use this information. So a glimmer of hope, but still lacking in a big way for the majority of these centers. The second main thing that was valuable, I think, about this paper was that it highlighted the deficiencies in reporting and the variability in reporting that came along with this. So we actually looked at all the different CPT codes and DRG codes that were reported in cervical spine fusion by all of these different centers, and they were all over the map. So it really just highlights that although there was this mandate did allow for more information to be posted, a lot of it is too nuanced to really be able to analyze on the level of detail that we would need as surgeons giving information to our patients or patients would need trying to access this. The third and final thing that I thought worthy of highlighting from the paper was that we looked at variability in reported cost, and we looked at it on a national level as well as even on local levels. And there was significant variability in the reported cost for this one essential service, cervical spine fusion, not only across the country, but even in the same geographic area. And I think that that highlights the potential utility of a functional tool like this, that there is variability between different centers, even within a same city. So if a patient did want to look up potential financial information about a proposed surgery, there would potentially be good information for them to be able to find. And maybe that would help them to make their decision on a pretty big factor in a lot of people's life. So altogether, this paper provided a snapshot of the current state and limitations of cost transparency for a very common operation that we perform, cervical spine fusion. And we hope that it raises some awareness and interest around the topic that I think will become increasingly relevant into the future.
Great. That was super comprehensive. We appreciate it. Dr. J, why don't you start with your questions?
Dr. Mooney, thank you so much. Again, your paper is very timely and very well written. Dr. Mooney, just to back up to the importance of price transparency, why is it so important, and what would its influence be on healthcare costs and selecting out the most cost-effective treatments, especially in spine?
Yeah, good question, and thank you. Kind of to put it all in context, I think that the goal is that it would help, as it does in other sectors of the economy, create competition in the marketplace, especially potentially locally, and give consumers, in this case our patients, the ability to compare those goods and services, the associated prices for them, which I think can have two main benefits. One, potentially to drive down cost, but also potentially increase quality. By making that information widely available and interpretable.
So Dr. Mooney, it seems like price transparency is an effort to move medicine in general towards a free market sort of an environment where it's governed by the laws of supply and demand. I think one of those components is absolutely price transparency, but another is education. It seems like the consumer has to be educated enough to actually be able to distinguish or differentiate the different services and goods and even providers that are out there in the market. So with that, do you think that US healthcare could ever move to a free market environment?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question and discussion. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on it as well. You know, I think that it can. I think that it's going to vary a lot depending on the environment, the populations in different areas of the country, populations in different health systems are going to vary significantly in their, for lack of a better term, health literacy. And I think that that probably will go a long way in this. I also think that it's challenging in a specialty like ours and in a field like spine surgery that not only is it about maybe being educated on this topic, but there's such variability in practice of what's being performed, what's being offered to a patient. That a patient can present to three spine surgeons with the same problem and come out with three completely different recommendations. And then what if, you know, they have to navigate that decision on the value of what they want to pursue, let alone any potential costs associated with any of those potential strategies. So there's so much variability in what is being performed that is definitely going to complicate patients' ability to navigate this kind of environment, especially in spine surgery, that those are important factors. But you take a straightforward case of an educated person, health literacy, one, two level ACDF, and they have recommendations of multiple surgeons, and they want to know what kind of impact this is going to have on them financially. I think that should be easy enough to determine that information for those people, and currently it's just not. It's nearly impossible.
Yeah,
But I'd love your follow-up on it, or any other thoughts from the panel.
to add to that, I feel like this is a complicated topic because not only does it concern understanding healthcare, it also concerns understanding health insurance as well as financial literacy. And to be honest, until I read your paper, I didn't even realize that there was a transparency tool. And then I was inspired to go look at our hospital's transparency tool. And it's quite complicated to navigate, even for me, even though I work in the system, because it requires knowledge of so many different areas, not just healthcare, but also finances and how insurance works, that I feel like the average patient, particularly in Oklahoma, would have trouble, even if they had access to this tool, understanding like what the cost details of their surgery would entail and what it all means and what's covered by the insurance and what's not. So I think overall, like this sort of education seems to be lacking in the US in general.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, a couple of the institutions I've worked in actually have navigators that can help patients with this kind of information. And it does vary throughout the fiscal year based on where a patient stands in their health plan with regards to their deductibles, out-of-pocket maximums, et cetera. And that is very individual level data that you're not going to be able to summarize in any kind of tool, but is the end result of what reaches the patient. You know, it depends on all of those factors. So that actually fit into our first paper that we wrote back in 2019, really trying to look at what did patients pay for the surgeries that they underwent out of their pocket. You know, what bill did they get in the mail? What did they pay? And we do see that that varies over the year as the deductibles are met and whatnot. But one of the key take homes from that paper was that nearly every surgery that we do in neurosurgery is going to exceed all of the out-of-pocket maximums for any reasonable plan. When it becomes really important, though, is in plans that are out there and are increasing in some degrees with a lot of cost sharing and co-insurance, that the patients are on the hook for a certain percentage of their care. And that can still be a main factor for them. And if it's early in the year and there's an out-of-pocket maximum that might be very high, and they're going to undergo a neurosurgical operation, they're going to be working toward that. The things that the healthcare we deliver is so expensive. So it's very much depends on their plan. Certain places I've worked have navigators that can help patients, but whether they know that resource is available, whether they're even factoring it into their care is a whole nother question, but it does become important and relevant for them. And some of them might not realize it right on the bat. They might only realize it when they start to see those bills.
Yeah, I would say to build on Helen's point and Dr. Jay's point, which is we're kind of going down this how dictated our system is by the third party payer system. You know, this is a broad and challenging question, but we are increasingly asked, or hopefully should be asked by, you know, legislators to kind of comment on how we should be informing, you know, their choices and how they're trying to address these price issues for patients. And that's probably how the HPTFR came around, you know, and whether it's perfect or imperfect is, you know, certainly it's a solution. Do you think there are we better off potentially spending money on trying to educate people to understand? Because I really don't think our patients understand even their third party payer very well, right? And how they can maximize that, or sometimes an emergency. Or should we be spending time on these kinds of things, you know, like the HPTFR, which maybe patients really don't see? They're not really looking up the cost of their total surgery. They're really focused on what am I going to have to pay out of pocket? What will I be on the hook for?
Yeah, I mean, great question. Really tough to know. My opinion and thought on it is that the HPTFR, a mandate like this, it has a role. It gives some, you know, impetus, some responsibility to the hospital system. I don't know that educating the patients more on how to use these would be effective enough. In my mind, it has to be driven from the health system, maybe from a standpoint of kind of patient satisfaction, that, you know, there would have to be kind of a uniform outreach right from the beginning to say, this is your scheduled surgery in this place, in your current insurance plan, and where you're at in the year. This is what you should expect to see. And I think that that might end up being driven by the individual health systems, and with the spin that it could increase patient understanding, patient quality, the overall patient experience. I think to rely on patients to do it their own and educate them on how to do it their own, it's going to be challenging. Because even as Helen said, to try to do this as a healthcare provider is a daunting task and challenging. And then you take somebody not familiar, and I just don't even know how we can expect that to move forward. But I do think that these kind of patient navigator type roles, something driven by the health systems, might be a good route to go. But that's kind of putting the onus on our health systems or our individual practices and things.
Yeah, and it is actually very hard to retain that staff, and, you know, to find in your budget for that, depending on which health system you're in. So I think it's a great idea, but hopefully hospitals prioritize that, because I do think patients care about their finances for sure.
Dr. J, what do you think about the patient education component, or where kind of a push could be made?
No, Dr. Moody, I didn't have an answer to that. I have a kind of a more, if the goal is to get healthcare into a free market environment where, it's really sensitive to supply and demand, I'm not sure that it'll ever get there. I think there's a reason why, people go to college and then the medical school and then the residency. And I don't think that, a patient seeking our care, it'd be reasonable for them to expect them to understand the subtleties of the services that we provide. And I like your answer better, Dr. Mooney, that the onus probably falls on the health system. It probably falls on our specialty to do that for our patients, to maybe develop a set of expected outcomes or common outcomes after, a neurosurgical procedure. Like, this is what you should expect. But I don't have a better answer than that.
I will say this work, beginning with the first out-of-pocket work and now this cost transparency tool, has really actually guided the way that I talk to a lot of my patients in the clinic. And I can tell some patients that this is going to have more of an impact than others. And I use the line with my patients that no one can be expected to afford any of the things that we do. So we have to go the route of insurance authorization, no matter if it means waiting extra weeks for your surgery to be scheduled, your MRI to be scheduled. We have to have them authorize it because nobody can afford these things. And I have very frank discussions with them about that. And I think that patients do appreciate that. I don't find often that they're questioning, what payments they're going to have to make for a surgery. So I'm not sure they're going out and trying to get that information through anywhere like a tool. But I do think that hospitals having some responsibility to provide that information is an important step in the right direction, that patients should have access to that information. There is important information that can be gathered from it. I think our paper shows that it's a long way from being operational, but we kind of sought to outline that, highlight that, and raise some of these questions in this field that I think are interesting for us all to consider, how they impact our patients and how we might counsel them on some issues like this.
Yeah, and to add to Dr. J and Dr. Mooney's point, I think it's particularly hard to name a price for what we do, especially say in cervical spine surgery. For like say a patient have a good outcome, become pain-free and improve in function after a cervical spine surgery, and you're asking them to put a price tag on it. There will be patients who say, I will do anything, I will pay anything to achieve that goal. But unfortunately, there's two aspects we can't cover. We can't cover, like, when you go on Amazon Prime, you buy a TV, Amazon Prime will ship you your TV for a certain amount of money in 2 days. However, when a patient comes to us and say, I want you to fix my spine and I'll pay you whatever, we can't guarantee the outcome. And also, different patients have different thresholds for what they're willing to pay and what sort of outcomes they're willing to accept. And it's really hard to name a price for a lot of these intangibles. So I think that's part of the reason why, like, up until like recently, patients have been okay with paying whatever it is the third party or the third party payer or the health system dictates. But it's sort of like, is that fair for the patient?
Helen, just to kind of stick with that analogy that you made. So, even before you make that purchase on Amazon, so that education piece is, people can tell the difference between a Sony and a Panasonic and a Samsung TV. They're able to experience it, maybe at their friend's house or, at Best Buy on the showroom floor, and then make a decision about it. But again, in healthcare, that's something that we lack, and I'm not sure that we'll ever get to that point where patients will be that educated to kind of make distinguish between different goods and services and providers.
Yeah, I do agree with that. And I think that spine care is an interesting angle to think of that from because it's different than other aspects of neurosurgery. It's different than cancer care, you know, which I think nobody, there's going to be much less importance for a patient to try to put a price on their cancer care than they might put a price on a service related to a spine surgery. And they have to balance themselves how much this is impacting my quality of life, how much this is going to impact my financial outlook, and that might factor in for them. So spine's an interesting angle to think of it. That's not the same as some of the other things that we do, but it was interesting for us to kind of take that angle on cervical spine fusion, knowing that's one of the 70 essential services laid out in this mandate. The data is available there, but it's very difficult to even tease out as a surgeon and medical professional. And I think that how that evolves in the future with regards to spine care, some of these more elective type operations, procedures, things we perform for patients is still yet to be determined.
That said, I would say as the tumor person in the call, I do have patients that actually say to me, you know, I have a terminal diagnosis potentially. I actually don't want to get a lot of expensive care because I'm worried about not even me, but my family having to pay it off after I'm gone. So while I totally agree about the more elective nature of spine making maybe bring the economics to the forefront, I would say it's for cancer patients who rack up a bill so quickly, right? You know, they really are also very aware. So I think it really will affect everybody, probably.
Good point. Yeah, very good point in a different angle. So.
Actually, one thing a question I had about the paper was, you mentioned that like in the paper that you know, tertiary care centers, like the cost estimate calculators don't really differentiate the cost for elective spine case versus an emergent spine case. And I feel like that the difference in charge, there would be a difference in charges for those. And especially in a lot of emergency cases, patients don't get a choice where they end up and can't really shop around. They get an ambulance and the ambulance takes them to the nearest place. How do you think that like the pricing for these emergency services or these, you know, say like a patient getting a cervical spine surgery for a less elective reason can be factored in?
Yeah, that's a challenging conundrum for those patients. I don't think that really applies to these tools in any way. Those charges, like you said, rack up so fast in any emergency, any ICU admission, come through an emergency room and end up in a surgery. It's a different beast than the elective care being sought out, you know, potentially at multiple locations. You know, I think that that's probably more relevant for the important work that's gone into the Surprise Billing Act and trying to prevent those out-of-network costs from really piling up on patients because, like we discussed a little bit ago, I mean, really, almost none of us can afford that. Even as physicians, the bills that some of these people might receive for surgical care, emergency care, ICU care, out-of-network just become astronomical. Cancer care, like Kimberly brought up. So, I don't think that that's necessarily the place where the tool would have any impact. It's probably more in that situation where somebody can shop around for an elective surgery if, say, they did have the same thing offered by a few surgeons, which is a stretch, as we mentioned. So, certainly a interesting challenge in our healthcare system that not fully addressed by this transparency, I think, in any way.
Yeah, but then at the same time, I think you mentioned that it caused, but these patients also have worse outcomes, which is something you see reflected in tertiary care centers, like higher costs yet worse outcomes, because they're taking care of all these emergent, truly non-elective patients because it's bundled in this calculator.
That's right.
Well, all, I think that was a great discussion. We are nearing the end of our time. I would like to thank everyone for our good discussion today, and it's certainly given me a lot to think about. Of course, thank you to our loyal listeners for continuing to support us. We hope you learned something today that will help you in your practice. And do remember, you can obtain 1.5 CME, which is complimentary to all CNS members. The link to the CME activity is available in the online education catalog at cns.org. See you all next month.